Though it is 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use right here on your FM dial. For those of you in Santa Cruz and the Central Coast region of California, this Saturday, May 3rd, is the 9th annual Snapshot Day. Well, what's a Snapshot Day? Well, spanning more than 300 miles of the coast from Pacifica in the north to Morro Bay in the south, the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary receives flows from over 100 freshwater streams and rivers. This community event provides a one-day snapshot of the health of the rivers and streams that flow into the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. We accomplish this goal in partnership with the sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers who systematically sample the stream water on this Saturday, May 3rd. Volunteers are trained to monitor temperature, dissolved oxygen, pH conductivity, and collect water samples for laboratory analysis of nutrients and bacteria levels. Volunteers collecting this valuable data play a key role in our community as stewards of our watersheds. The information they provide is used by resource agencies, local governments, and community groups to protect and improve the health of our local streams. This year will be the 9th annual Snapshot Day. We'll be meeting at the north entrance to Natural Bridges State Park at the corner of Natural Bridges and Delaware Avenue at 9 o'clock in the morning. We'll be there to greet you, get you signed up, organized with a team and equipment. There will be a few speakers joining us briefly before you head out. We hope you'll enjoy the snacks and coffee provided when you arrive, and while all our preparations are going on, please bring drinking water, dress in layers, wear sturdy shoes or wading boots, or any other essential you feel necessary for your outing. Bring a camera if you can. We hope you'll have a great day. It looks like a wonderful day. The weather should be warm, maybe a little breezy. You never know. And we appreciate your participation in this year's event. This is provided by the Coastal Watershed Council. Give them a call tomorrow, the last day to sort of get information before the event. Their number, 464-9200. That's 831-464-9200. Or go to their website, www.coastal-watershed.org. Coastal-watershed.org. And remember, this Saturday, May 3rd at 9 a.m. at the north entrance to Natural Bridges State Park, the corner of Natural Bridges in Delaware, 9 a.m. Uncle Dennis will be there. Uncle Dennis, I believe, is sampling the Arana Gulch watershed. So if you, but that's just, like I say, one of 300 some streams that are 100 some streams that are going to be sampled on this Saturday Snapshot Day. Let's move to the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. This week, in the Yellowstone National Park's western boundary, the largest buffalo slaughter since the 18th century continues, even after Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer promised 2 weeks ago that no more buffalo would be killed this season. The Montana Department of Livestock blatantly ignored the government's statement and captured 3 bull buffalo at the Duck Creek Trap on Monday and shipped them to slaughter without any testing on Tuesday morning. The continuation of the buffalo slaughter this week by the Montana Department of Livestock adds injury to insult, with more than a third of the Yellowstone bison population having been eliminated since last November with no signs of stopping. The historic announcement issued by Governor Schweitzer on April 17th, allowing buffalo more room to roam outside the park boundaries, apparently has no merit along the park's western boundary. Even on the northern boundary of the Park Service still continues to haze and harass the country's last wild and free-roaming buffalo. 289 bison are currently being held at the Stevens Creek Trap, some having been confined there for over 2 months. Stevens Creek Trap has become a glorified buffalo feedlot, with grass and hay rations fed to the buffalo in masses, and just another factor contributing to the over-domestication of these purely wild beings. Pregnant female bison held at the Stevens Creek Trap have given birth to 27 new calves this week, along with 2 stillborns, making a total of 53 calves born in the trap. The Park Service is still waiting for Greenup to release the bison from captivity, but the effect of captivity on newborn calves is yet to be seen. Wild buffalo are migratory animals, learning from a young age from the elders in their family groups how to survive. Being born in captivity, these newborn buffalo calves may suffer a severe disadvantage when they must fend for themselves in the wild. Since the governor's announcement that the Church Universal and Triumphant and the National Park Service have reached a compromise to allow buffalo room to roam on church lands, things are still bad for buffalo. Bison to continue to roam out of the park to seek to the church land in search of winter grass, and the Park Service continues to haze them back. Any buffalo allowed to remain on church land must run the gauntlet first. They must be captured and tested, then implanted with vaginal transmitters before the Park Service will let them graze on church land, and then only 25 buffalo are allowed at a time. While the sad news just keeps coming, there is a bright note for buffalo on the western boundary. This is the time of the year when our field patrols get to experience firsthand the beauty of new life, with buffalo calving season well underway. Our volunteers have had the pleasure of witnessing newborn buffalo taking their first awkward steps into the world. It is obvious by watching these newborns and after their first few hours of life being able to walk right in pace with the herd by their mother's sides that buffalo are genetically meant to roam. After a long season of slaughter this year, the first-hand experience of witnessing new buffalo life come to this world gives hope and determination for all of us who continue the fight for the rights of the sacred, ancient, and beautiful creatures that are bison. And that's the news from the Buffalo Field Campaign. You can reach the Buffalo Field Campaign. Their address, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. The zip code, give them a call at 406-646-0070. They are looking for summer volunteers at this time. So get to their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and find out what you need to do to get out there. They'll need help fixing up all their housing and their cars and trucks and equipment, as well as going out and tabling at Yellowstone National Park during the summer and talking to all the tourists. Once again, that's www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day to in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. Moving north to British Columbia, a British Columbia logging company gives back their logging permit. Lizzie Bay Logging has given up its rights to log in a controversial area of Blackwater Creek in British Columbia. A Ministry of Forests and Range spokesperson this week confirmed the company had decided not to harvest timber in Tree License Area BL-002. While there are no plans to resell the license at this time, said the spokesperson, it could be resold in the future. That's good news for the community and the Blackwater Stewardship Group. The group grabbed headlines close to a year ago when it set up a protest camp near the proposed logging area. Protesters wanted to save a 17-hectare area, that's about 35 acres, where traditional medicinal plants and valuable pine mushrooms were regularly harvested. They claimed that there had not been proper consultation between the residents in the area, the Enquatqua First Nations Band, and British Columbia Timber Sales. We have started to dialogue with British Columbia Timber Sales, and they have been really open to communicate and hear our concerns, and they have expressed their intent to continue to meet with us periodically, said Blackwater Stewardship Group member Mariko Cage. We are unable to confirm last Friday that, yes, indeed, Lizzie Bay has returned its license, and they do not plan to have any harvesting this spring or summer. Cage, while pleased with the development, said it is most likely the result of trouble in the timber industry as a whole, which has been in steady decline in lumber prices, the downturn in the U.S. housing market, and the appreciation of the Canadian dollar, which makes Canadian timber worth less. We are happy that we are part of a delaying in the process a little bit to the point where market concerns took over, said Cage. And moving to Australia, the Tarkine Road controversy continues. The Tasmanian Greens today, and that was a week ago, I guess, raised concerns about proposed logging of trees along the Tarkine Road, also known as the Western Explorer, following a major fire in the area, saying that they fear that along with clearing trees, posing a danger to travelers, salvage logging could target forest areas not normally accessible for logging. Greens opposition leader Peg Putt, Member of Parliament, said that The following questions must be urgently answered. Who is doing the logging? Will any of the wood be milled or sold commercially? Are any of the trees to be logged from conservation reserves? Is there a forest practices plan for the logging operation? What independent oversight of operations is planned, and will logging equipment make new snig tracks and otherwise affect the environment? And I'm not sure what a snig track is, but let's just call it a haul road or something like that. I'll have to look that one up. It's a bit of Australian slang, I guess. We are worried that a concern for safety of travelers along the Tarkine Road will transmute into a salvage logging operation that targets areas normally off limits for logging and may involve removing trees from reserves, Ms. Putt said. Forestry Tasmania or the Department of Infrastructure and Resources should answer the questions that arise from their stated intention to log along the road, in particular where it is planned to use the wood commercially, whether reserves are targeted, whether forest practices plans are in place, and what independent monitoring will occur. Following wildfires in Victoria some years ago, a scandal erupted over salvage logging conducted subsequently on the pretext of safety, but going much farther in affecting areas not normally allowed to be logged whilst evading the usual planning processes, and we don't want anything like that to be happening in the Tarkine. Windfall profits are believed to have been made from the Victoria operation. There must be no commercial imperative attached to logging plans or a profit motive that may lead to more logging and environmental impact than strictly necessary. If trees are to be logged out on reserves, it must be restricted to the bare minimum. No commercial sale of the timber should occur, and a thorough assessment against the conservation management plans for the reserve must occur with appropriate community input. The environmental damage inflicted on the area by this ill-conceived road continues to snowball. First the road, then the inevitable wildfire started by a road user, and now forest areas adjacent to the road are to be cut, allegedly to ensure traveler safety, Miss Putt said. And Australian logging protesters arrested. 20 protesters have halted logging in an old-growth forest southwest of Hobart. One activist was sitting in a tree 30 meters, that's about 100 feet off the ground, on Monday morning, while another protester was chained to logging machinery at the forest in the Little Denison Valley, 35 kilometers west of Huonville, a spokesman for the group said. Huon Valley Environment Center spokesman Warwick Jordan told Australian AP, some logging contractors left the site Monday morning when faced with the protest. The local community is determined to stop this logging operation, he said. People are sick and tired of seeing these last remaining areas of forest destroyed to line the pockets of Guns Limited and Japanese paper companies, he said. Mr. Jordan accused the state and federal governments of cozying up to the wood chipping industry. He said he expected protesters would remain at the site for the rest of the day. Comment was being sought from Forestry Tasmania. Forestry Tasmania Acting Managing Director Peggy Egan refused to comment directly on the protest in a statement through a spokesman, she said. 79% of Tasmania's old-growth forests are in reserve, with 100 million old-growth trees permanently protected. Less than 1% of state forest is harvested for wood products and regrown each year. Four people have been arrested while protesting against logging in the southern Tasmanian forest, while 20 protesters attempted to stop logging. The spokesperson for the Huon Valley Environment Center, Warwick Jordan, said those arrested had been unfairly treated, but police said they had violently resisted. Forest defenders engaged in legitimate, peaceful protest did not deserve this treatment, Mr. Jordan said. Local police, without warning, arrested three activists as they were preparing to leave the forest blockade and threatened them with pepper spray and pushed them into a police car. A Luckiston woman was also arrested after being removed from logging machinery. Police spokeswoman Jody De Cesari said police responded to a call from Forestry Tasmania complaining about protesters allegedly blocking access to the area and securing themselves to machinery. One of the males resisted being placed in a divisional van and was told that pepper spray would be used if he continued to kick violently while resisting arrest, risking injury to himself and or others, she said. He then followed police directions and OC, that is, pepper spray, was not deployed. Four people were arrested and are expected to be charged with failing to comply with the directions of a police officer, willfully obstructing police and resisting arrest, Ms. DeCesari said. One activist sat in a tree 100 feet above the ground while another was chained. The forest is valued by the protesters for its giant eucalyptus regnan trees, while wedge-tailed eagle nests are also found in the forest, Mr. Jordan said. And a Canadian oil firm is probed as hundreds of ducks die. Story by Scott Haggett, reporting by Scott Haggett, and editing by Rob Wilson of the Reuters News Service. Hundreds of dead or dying ducks could cost Canada's biggest oil sands producer $1 million after the migrating waterfowl landed in a pond of oily toxic sludge in northern Alberta. Syncrude Canada's operations were under investigation by environmental regulators on Wednesday after as many as 500 birds landed in the wastewater known as a tailings pond at the Aurora North Mine near Fort McMurray, Alberta. Migrating waterfowl are supposed to be kept from the poisonous waters at the mine, where massive shovels pull tons of oil-laden sand from the ground by sound cannons that simulate gunfire. But a winter storm had delayed deployment of the system, a Syncrude spokesman said. We have a deterrent program in place that's effective, said Alan Moore. We've had it in operation for 30 years and hadn't had something like this occur at our site. But we did have some unusual circumstances. The incident is the latest environmental black eye for Canada's booming oil sands region, where more than $1 billion is being poured into projects to tap the biggest storehouse of oil outside of the Middle East. Environmental groups have already raised concerns about carbon dioxide emissions, destruction of the boreal forest that is stripped away to get at the oil deposits, and the potential for tailing ponds to contaminate local rivers. Greenpeace said it was an anonymous call that tipped government regulators to the bird deaths, and it attacked what it described as rampant development of the oil sands. This speaks to the inadequacies of the government's ability to monitor even the most basic environmental safeguards that put tar sands development. Greenpeace's Mike Hudima said in a statement, the incident made national headlines as Ron Stevens, Alberta's deputy premier, was in Washington to let U.S. legislators know the province represents an environmentally responsible source of energy supply to the United States. Alberta's Environment Ministry said in a release it had investigators at the site. Alberta requires that Syncrude have a waterfowl protection plan in place that includes a comprehensive bird deterrent program for all tailing ponds, the minister said in a release. If Syncrude did not comply, the Alberta government will take action with penalties up to $1 million. Too bad for the ducks, they're already dead. Congo elephants killed as ivory demand jumps, in this story by Joe Bavier, writing by Alastair Thompson and editing by Pascal Fletcher of the Reuters News Service. Soldiers, rebels, and villagers in Democratic Republic of Congo killed 14 elephants in as many days in Africa's oldest national park to meet rising Chinese demand for ivory, a conservation group has said. Besides a dwindling population of a few hundred elephants, western Congo's Virunga National Park is home to bands of Congolese army soldiers, Mai Mai warriors turned militia, and Rwandan Hutu rebels after years of regional warfare. All three groups, as well as local villagers, killed 14 elephants in the park between April 14th and the 27th, WildlifeDirect.org said in a statement citing information from Congo's State Conservation Agency. The upsurge in elephant killings in Virunga is part of a widespread slaughter across the Congo Basin, Emmanuel De Marodi, director of Wildlife Direct Organization, said. It is being driven by developments on the international scene, the liberalization of the ivory trade being pushed by South Africa, and the increased presence of Chinese operators on the ground, who feed a massive domestic demand for ivory in their home country, he said. Asia is recognized as a major market for poached ivory. The number of Chinese laborers and traders in Africa has risen in recent years, including Congo, where China is investing huge sums in mining and has military units serving with the world's biggest United Nations peacekeeping force. South Africa has long urged a relaxation of the ivory trading prohibition and lifted a ban on elephant culling on Thursday after years of debate on how to control fast-rising populations that have come into conflict with humans. Congolese General Vinkir Mayala, the army's top commander in North Kivu, said he had not been informed about the accusation that his troops had killed 5 of the 14 elephants. I will consult with my special services to see how we can find a solution. They will have to carry out an investigation on the ground, but that shouldn't take too long, he told Reuters. Poaching of gorillas and elephants has long been a problem in Virunga, but April saw a sharp rise in elephant killings. Alexander Wathut, provincial director of Congo's conservation authorities in North Kivu province, told Reuters. The tusks had been hacked from 13 of the carcasses. Six villagers were caught red-handed and detained with the tusks of the 14th Wildlife Direct Organization. Spokesperson Pierre Perron said the killings could threaten the viability of Virunga's elephant population. The park's elephant population shrank by 90% between 1959, the year before independence from Belgium, and the most recent survey in 2006, where there were found to be just 350 elephants left. Numbers have thought to have fallen further, unlike populations in Botswana, Zimbabwe, and South Africa, which have flourished since a 1989 ban on international ivory trading. The ban was extended by 9 years last year under a deal that allowed a one-off sale of government ivory stocks. And moving to Northern California, Simpson Timber agrees to clean up dioxin in this story by Sarah Wilmot of the Humboldt Lumberjack. Adjacent to Humboldt Bay's only public fishing pier is a drainage ditch that is rampant with the cancer-causing chemical dioxin. This ditch is located on property formerly owned by Simpson Timber Company and drains directly into Humboldt Bay. Dioxin levels in the ditch are thousands of times higher than Environmental Protection Agency standards. State Water Resource Control Board listed Humboldt Bay as an impaired last year after dioxin was found in the tissue of local fish and oysters. Dioxin is from a family of chemicals, some of which are the most toxic substances known. It has a wide range of negative impacts for people and other species. Cancer, birth defects, and neurological problems can occur starting from very low levels of exposure. Patty Clary is the policy director for Californians for the Alternatives to Toxic. Over the past 15 years, she has worked with families who have been negatively impacted by the effects of dioxin, Clary said. There is no doubt in my mind there is a direct correlation between a bay's dioxin levels and the contamination of the ditch on the Simpson property. Simpson Timber Company's use of the now widely banned wood preservative pentachlorophenol, or penta, in the 1960s resulted in the presence of dioxin in the drainage ditch. Pete Nichols, executive director of the Humboldt Baykeepers, explained that the dioxin got into the drainage ditch when the timber company sprayed wood products with penta. The chemical was easily splashed and dripped onto the ground. He said the treated wood was stored outside, and when it rained, much of the wood preservative would wash off and drain into the ditch. I would tell people that if they are going to eat fish from the bay, don't eat a lot of it. While we can't test every fish, enough tests have been done to know that dioxin is getting into them, Nichols said. It's not just an environmental issue, but it's a public health issue as well. We're not sure of the impact so far. Simpson Timber Company recently reached a settlement in a lawsuit brought against them by Humboldt Baykeepers and Californians for Alternatives to Toxics. There was a lot of back and forth, but at the end of the day, Simpson Timber realized that we had proven our case, Nichols said. Under the settlement, Simpson Timber Company is responsible for removing the dioxin-ridden sediment from the ditch and transporting it to a licensed disposal site. They will also install 12 monitoring wells that will evaluate any migration of remaining dioxin towards Humboldt Bay, Nichols said. There are things that Simpson Timber Company should commence in the next year, and we are going to make sure that the cleanup gets done right. Ken Harris, the state total maximum daily load program manager for the State Water Resources Control Board, explains that once a body of water is listed as impaired by their agency, the process of reversing the impairment should begin immediately. Responsible parties are given timelines, Harris said. Once the body of water meets certain water quality standards and fish quality standards, it can be removed from the list. Once the dioxin leakage is eliminated, the dioxin will continue to break down and become covered with natural sediments in the bay. The buildup of natural sediments largely depends on weather patterns. Rainfall is a main component of the sediment buildup. The more rain Humboldt County has, the faster the sediment will be buried and the dioxin with it. Humboldt Bay Keepers and Californians for Alternative to Toxins hope it will only be a matter of a few years before Humboldt Bay is restored and eligible to be removed from the list of impaired water bodies. Clary said, It's like this chemical was innocent until proven guilty, but the bay can be restored, and it will be. And Fish and Wildlife Service ignores Congress and experts on the northern spotted owl in this story by Caitlin Hills of the American Lands Alliance. The Fish and Wildlife Service refused direct requests made by both chambers of Congress to allow for scientific peer review and public comment of the soon-to-be-released Northern Spotted Owl Recovery Plan in early April. Senators Ron Wyden, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Maria Cantwell, and Pat Murray sent a letter to Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne requesting the Fish and Wildlife Service conduct a 45-day peer review of the latest version of the recovery plan for the owl. In the House, Natural Resources Committee Chairman Nick Rahal and Representative Peter DeFazio sent a letter to the Fish and Wildlife Service requesting a 90-day public comment period. The Fish and Wildlife Service sent a letter to Representative DeFazio on April 18th refusing his request for a public comment period. The Department of Interior has not responded to the Pacific Northwest Senator's request. This blatant disregard of Congress came on the heels of the release of a report by a panel of experts assembled by the Sustainable Ecosystems Institute in Portland that found the draft spotted owl recovery plan underestimates the importance of protecting old-growth forest habitat compared to the threat from a competing species, the barred owl. The review was commissioned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after the draft owl recovery plan was flunked by three organizations who also conducted peer review on the plan: the Society of Conservation Biology, the American Ornithologists Union, and the Wildlife Society. By refusing a legitimate request for independent scientific review of the recovery plan, the administration has once again demonstrated its disdain for relying on science to make decisions on threatened and endangered species, said Randy Spivak, executive director of the American Lands Alliance. Instead, they prefer to manipulate the science to suit their agenda. How unusual. The northern spotted owl was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 1990, and critical habitat was designated in 1992. Recovery of the owl is about more than this one species. Like a canary in a coal mine, the owl is an indicator species of the health of the remaining old-growth forests, clean water, salmon, and habitat for other species. In 1994, the Northwest Forest Plan became the cornerstone for conserving the northern spotted owl on 24.4 million acres of federal forests in Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. The Bush administration has been trying to increase old-growth logging on these public lands for the past 8 years by dismantling the Northwest Forest Plan. A weak owl recovery plan is needed by this administration to meet timber industry demands to significantly increase old-growth logging on federal forests. Reducing old-growth forest protections for the spotted owl would also allow the Bureau of Land Management's proposal for a 700% increase in old-growth logging in southern Oregon to move forward. In early 2006, the Fish and Wildlife Service assembled the Northern Spotted Owl Recovery Team to assist in the development of their plan. The plan that they released, with heavy involvement from high-level Washington Oversight Committee, comprised of administration officials, was roundly denounced by leading scientific societies as not being based on the best available science and not designed to recover the species. This overwhelming critique, along with 80,000 comments from the public, forced the Fish and Wildlife Service to engage Sustainable Ecosystems Institute as a private contractor to analyze the draft plan. The SEI report found that the draft owl recovery plan did not use scientific information appropriately. The method they used to design the amount of habitat to be preserved, the technique used was wrong and was not based on good science, the report stated. How many times does the Fish and Wildlife Service have to be told that their plan is not going to lead to the recovery of the spotted owl? How many more millions of taxpayer dollars will be used to push through a tainted plan? Asked Caitlin Hills, Forest Program Director of the American Lands Alliance. It seems to me that the Fish and Wildlife Service and this administration are doing everything in their power to pave the way for clear-cutting the mature and old-growth public forests of the Pacific Northwest. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news tonight on the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is produced by Earth First Radio and is brought to you from the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear podcasts of the Earth First Update, you can do that at the following webpage. There's no W's in this. It's h2opodcast.com/earthfirst earth.html, and the E and the F in Earth First are capitalized. And for some reason, they have to be in order for this to work. Once again, that webpage, h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com/EEarthFirst.html. And that's all one word, by the way. And we thank them for providing that podcast for Earth First Update. You can listen to the Earth First podcast every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz and www.freakradio.org. And we thank you for listening. And hopefully in the next few minutes we will be receiving a phone call from the trees. But until then, let's listen to some music. Freak Radio. Yeah, perfect. Okay. All right, let's get you on there. Hold on. I'm afraid we're going to have to...
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. We're going to have to...
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I'm joking.
We had to turn down the cream there for a second, just so we can fly to the trees here. On the phone with me is Owl. Sitting up in the trees at UCSC. How are things up there tonight?
Very nice. The wind is... days of really pretty gusty activity. I'd say in the 25-30 mile an hour range there, pretty consistently for 2 days, wreaking havoc on the banners, but heard good things about the march and rally for May Day here on campus, and have been hearing good things all over the world for May Day, and happy Beltane everybody, and yeah, we're still holding strong here in parking lot 121.
Well, great, great. Just to remind our listeners that Owl is up a tree because of the long-range development plan put forward by UCSC. And in specifically, I believe the parking lot that you're in is going to be turned into a biological research facility.
Yeah, it's a bogus plan. This is what they call an infill project to wipe out over 100 redwood trees and put up a six-story like facility that is that's a fancy name for vivisection lab, and vivisection is a fancy word for animal torture. So it's a bad package. The people who built this university respected the trees. They left the old-growth stumps. They respected the fairy rings of second-growth trees here. So we're taking concrete direct action here to stop the cutting the university would begin with if they were going to actually get started on this plan. The next phase of the plan is even more horrendous. It's a 120-acre deforestation of upper campus, paving and developing everything from upper remote parking all the way to Cave Gulch up on Empire Grade, and paving all those... currently narrow dirt fire break roads, turning those into two-lane roads with bike lanes and sidewalks. So it's a disturbing vision.
And I heard today that there is apparently going to be a decision coming down in the Oakland tree sit up in Berkeley at any moment. I gave a call up there, and perhaps those folks are going to call back a little later tonight, but I wondered if you'd gotten any word from the Berkeley folks.
No, but as you can hear me hand cranking the charger on my cell phone, I'm usually the last guy to find out anything, even about events concerning our own campaign. I'm hopeful that the Berkeley decision expected.
Yeah, apparently it hasn't come down yet, but the situation in Oakland is pretty similar to the situation here, in Oakland, they plan to build a sports facility right on an earthquake fault, and to do it, they're tearing out hundreds of oak trees up there, mature oak trees up in the hills above Berkeley. So
yeah, that were planted as a memorial to people who lost their lives in World War I. So it's a sacred trust with the trees, it's a sacred trust with the memories of the people they were planted for, and it's on a fault line. And again, both projects are unnecessary. It's the case of the Regents. Using the urgent logic of budget cuts and expanding student populations, they're using that as a front while they raise money from corporations to build these prestige projects, fancy sports facilities in Berkeley, or even more alarmingly, pharmaceutical corporate-funded animal research here at UC. There's a lot of movement afoot to take on the whole structure of the Regency, I call it, to put pressure on Governor Schwarzenegger to change the whole structure of how the public universities in California are run. But in the meantime, those folks up in Berkeley, over 500 days now, and we're coming up on 6 months on May 7th, occupying the canopy here in UC Santa Cruz, city on a hill here.
Well, I took a chance myself to visit your tree sit the other day, and there's a lot of interesting information in the trees for people to read. But if folks want
all kinds of signage, I actually updated some of the signage, and I have a feeling that we're going to change up our May Day banner, because the times they are changing, and May Day is just about up. But our May Day banner said "No justice, no peace." And that's really been a head-turner. I've been making a lot of cardboard signs up on my windows still here, but they're not nearly as legible as the banners.
And you do still need support.
Always.
Tree sits are ongoing campaigns. Tree sitters need to be fed and kept warm, and at least now, my understanding is you can pick up free radio. And
we sure can. I was listening for my cue and called in right on time tonight, thanks to Guardian Angel there at Free
Radio.
Well,
I'll take full responsibility for the fact that Owl can listen to free radio.
White Knight with the white radio right on time.
I tell you, when I heard that you couldn't pick up free radio from a tree sit at UCSC, I had to act immediately. So
the funny thing about the new radio, it picks up Freak Radio perfectly well. It's a little more sensitive to KZSC than the old radio. The old radio was indifferent alike. The new radio really likes KZSC, and you can pick up KZSC in all the gaps all the way through the FM dial. I don't know if that's a design feature of the new one, or
that's
our proximity to the tower.
That's your proximity to the tower. Unfortunately, and free radio has the same problem with people who live next to our transmitter.
No doubt. Well, they're getting a better earful then.
I've got a call coming in from Oakland.
Oh, all right. So, I'll find out what the word is.
Okay, hold on a sec here. Hello, Freak Radio. Okay, right now I'm talking to the tree sitter at UCSC. Could you call back at 469-3119 in about 5 minutes, and we'll put you on the air? 831-469-3119, and we'll put you right on the air. Give me a few minutes to wrap up with Owl here at UCSC Tree Sit, and then we'll talk to you about the Oakland Tree Sit. Berkeley.
Yeah,
call me in 4 or 5 minutes. Bye-bye. Well, I'm glad that worked out. So,
age before beauty. Let you get on to their update. But as you can attest, having brought us the beautiful disaster preparedness radio that I decorated with a little anarchy symbol. It's not just easy to bring us stuff here at the Tree Sit at UC Santa Cruz. It's fun.
It is fun.
You've brought stuff to Tree Sits before, so it was nothing new to you. But I've watched a lot of people's faces light up, and it just charges their whole day, maybe even more than that, to come and show their support one way or another. Do yourself some good and come on out and throw something in the bag.
And that's LRDPResistance.org?
LRDPResistance.org. You can see movies and hear interviews at IndieBay.org on the Santa Cruz page. There's some more documentaries with people, been some people out here with cameras and microphones and whatnot, exploring the canopy here with us. And so that's coming out soon. And happy Beltane, everybody. And big solidarity to everybody who marched today everywhere. And to those kids up in Berkeley, solidarity and hasta la victoria siempre with a half a million people out in Cuba today for May Day. But
all right, Al. Well, thanks a lot for calling in, and we'll get an update from you next week, maybe.
Right on. Thanks for the radio. Have a good night, everybody. See you soon.
Bye, Al. We've been speaking with Al up a tree in UCSC, and hopefully in just three or four more minutes, we'll be talking to the folks up at the Berkeley Tree Sit, talking to the Berkeley Tree Sit support group up there. So stay tuned to Free Radio for more environmental updates. Meanwhile, I'll have a little music here. Hello, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
What's up, Free Radio Santa Cruz? This is Air from the Oak Grove Tree Sit in Berkeley. Currently in San Francisco after a full day marching in the streets for May Day.
Well, great. We just got off the phone with Al, who's the tree sitter at UCSC.
My Bretchen.
Right, but we did receive an email message that apparently the judge is about to make a decision about the tree sitters in Berkeley. What's going on?
Well, yes, it's true. She can make a decision anytime. Probably instead of red alert, it should have said yellow alert, because she does have until mid-June, so the decision could come between any time between now and mid-June. We just wanted to give people a heads up that the decision can come at any time, to be on their toes, to be keeping their ears open, because when a decision does come down, we want to make it sure the university knows it doesn't really matter what the court decision is, that they need to listen to the community's desires and protect that native burial ground, one memorial, wildlife corridor, and beautiful place that we have been occupying for 17 months now, which, as far as we know, is the longest urban tree sit in North American history.
All right. Give us, some of our listeners, a little bit better idea about exactly where this tree sit is and why the tree sit is where it is.
Okay, perfect. So the tree sit is located right above University of California Berkeley campus. So it's not actually on campus. It's right above campus, and it's right between campus and their football stadium. Now, for years and years, Cal had a football team that didn't do that well, and it didn't really bother anybody, and nobody really cared. But in the last several years, the football team has been doing much better, and, of course, college football is a $100 million business. I mean, billions of dollars flow because of college football. And so, basically, because they were doing better, and the university saw it as a way to kind of draw in more money and also, you know, kick contracts to their friends, they came up with this idea to build a $150 million gym for the football team, and they decided it had to be right where the Oak Grove was. Now, the Oak Grove itself, it should be understood, it's several things. First of all, when they blew up the hill to build the stadium, they blew up one of the most beautiful places in the East Bay. It was the creek is Strawberry Creek, and it was a cascading waterfall that kind of bottomed out into a swimming hole. Now they blew up the hill and they culverted that, all that, and now that culvert runs right under the football field. Along parallel with that is called the Hayward Fault, and that's the most active fault in California, and due to have a big quake any day now. It's on a 140-year cycle type thing, and it's been 140 years since the last big one on that fault. So basically, it was a bad idea to blow up the hill to build the stadium, obviously, but that was done. It was done against the wishes of the students at the time and the professors, one of whom quit and went on to form UCLA. This was back in the 20s. So now that we move forward, what they did is at the time they planted, there was already some trees out there. Some were native oak trees that already were there. Some were native redwood trees that were there. Others were trees that had been planted by the settlers and the homesteaders. And then what they did is they said, we'll plant a few more oak trees out there. We'll do it in memory of the veterans who died in World War One. You know, then we have Memorial Stadium and Memorial Oak Grove. So, and it was what we would call it today is mitigation. At the time, it wasn't legally binding mitigation. So, you know, they didn't call it that. But that's what it was. They basically gave that to the people as a mitigation for destroying one of the most beautiful places in the East Bay, according to the founding members of the Sierra Club. It, you know, it was one of their first big fights. Also, when they blew up the hill to build the stadium, they've also found the remains of Native Americans, not on the creek side, but on the side, other side, which faced the bay. So going downhill from the top of that hill, away from the creek, towards the bay, they had found there was a Native burial ground. So when they blew up the hill, they found several remains of Native American people, 18, we believe, according to their environmental impact report. So we still feel there's Native bones buried where we're at, because there's trees that predate the stadium where we're at. So they didn't dig up all the ground. You know, they dig up a little bit here and there to plant some trees, but they did not wholesale dig up all the ground that we're on. So we feel that it's a Native burial ground that needs to be respected and protected. It's also a World War One memorial. Those trees, some of them were planted in memory of the veterans who died from California in World War One. It's also a wildlife corridor. Since I've been there, and before they built two barbed wire fences around the trees,